Soldiers, said Ali, make me safe. Meanwhile, I will continue my conversation with these visitors who are under the protection of my hospitality. Two soldiers dragged the prisoner away, while the others took off at a run. You have work to do, said Peter.
I've just done it, said Ali.
He turned to Petra. Thank you for seeing what I needed. Being a provocateur comes naturally to me, she said. I hope we've been helpful. Everything that you said has been heard, said Ali, and I assure you that when it's actually in my power to control the armies of Islam, they will behave as true Muslims and not as barbarian conquerors. Meanwhile, however, I'm afraid that bloodshed is likely, and I believe you will be safest here with me in this garden for the next half hour or so. Hot soup has just taken over in China, said Petra. So I've heard. And he's taking the title of emperor, she added. Back to the good old days. A new dynasty in Beijing now faces the restored caliphate in Damascus, said Petra. It would be a terrible thing for members of the Jish to have to choose up sides. Surely that's not what battle school was ever meant to accomplish.
Battle school? Said Ali.
They may have identified us, but we already were who we were before they laid a hand on us. Do you think that without battle school I could not be where I am, or Hansu where he is? Look at Peter Wiggin. He didn't go to battle school, but he got himself appointed hegemon. An empty title, said Peter.
It was when you got it, said Ali.
Just as my title was until 2 minutes ago, but when you sit in the chair and wear the hat, some people don't understand that it's just a play and start obeying you as if you had real power, and then you have real power, ne?
Eh, said Petra.
Peter smiled. I'm not your enemy, Ali, he said.
You are not my friend either, said Ali.
But then he smiled. The question is whether you'll turn out to be a friend to humanity, or whether I will. He turned back to Petra. And so much depends on what your husband chooses to do before he dies. Petra nodded gravely. He'd prefer to do nothing except enjoy the months, or perhaps years he'll have with me and our child.
God willing, said Ali,
that's all he'll be required to do. A soldier came pounding across the flagstones.
So the compound is secure, and none of the council have escaped.
I'm happy to hear that, said Ali.
Three councilmen are dead, sir, said the soldier.
It could not be helped.
I'm sure that is the truth, said Ali.
They are now in God's hands.
The rest are in mine, and now I must try to do what God would have me do.
Now, my son, will you take these two friends of the Caliph safely back to their hotel? Our conversation is finished, and I wish them to be free, to leave Damascus unhindered and unrecognized. No one will speak of their presence in this garden on this day.
Yes, my Caliph, said the soldier.
He bowed, then turned to Peter and Petra. Will you come with me, friends of the Caliph?
Thank you, Petra said. The Caliph is blessed with true servants in this house.
The man did not acknowledge her praise. This way, he said to Peter. As they followed him back to the enclosed van, Peter wondered whether he might have unconsciously planned for the events that happened here today, or whether it was just dumb luck, or whether Petra and Ali planned it, and Peter was nothing more than their pawn, thinking foolishly that he was making his own decisions and conducting his own strategy. Or are we, as the Muslims believe, only acting out the script of God? Not likely. Any God worth believing in could make up a better plan than the mess the world was in now. In my childhood, I set my hand to improving the world. And for a while, I succeeded. I stopped a war through words I wrote on the nets when people didn't know who I was. But now I have the empty title of hegemon. Wars are swirling back and forth across swaths of the earth like a reaper's scythe.
Vast populations are seething under the whips of new oppressors, and I am powerless to change a thing.
Chapter 4. Bargain. From Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov, to Sacred Cause, one man at freetie.org. Ray, Siri Yawang's actions concerning Achille Flandre. Dear Amble, at all times during Achille Flandre's infiltration of the hegemony, Siri Yawang acted as my agent inside Flandre's growing organization. It was at my instructions that he pretended to be Flandre's staunch ally, and that was why, at the crucial moment when Julian Delphiki faced the monster, Siri Yawang and his elite soldiers acted for the good of all humankind, including Thailand, and made possible the destruction of the man who, more than any other, was responsible for the defeat and occupation of Thailand. This is the public story, as you pointed out. Now, I point out that, in this case, the public story also happens to be the complete truth. Like you, Siri Yawang is a battle school graduate. China's new emperor and the Muslim caliph are both battle school graduates. But they are two of those chosen to take part in my brother Ender's famous jish. Even if you discount their actual brilliance as military commanders, the public perception of their powers is at the level of magic. This will affect the morale of your soldiers as surely as of theirs. How do you suppose you will keep Thailand free if you reject Siri Yawang? He is no threat to your leadership. He will be your most valuable tool against your enemies. Sincerely, Peter, Hegemon.
Bean stooped to pass through the doorway. He wasn't actually tall enough to bang his head, but it had happened often enough in other doorways that once would have given him plenty of room, that now he was overcautious. He didn't know what to do with his hands, either. They seemed too big for any job he might need them for. Pens were like toothpicks. His finger filled the trigger guard of many a pistol. Soon he'd have to butter his finger to get it out, as if the pistol were a too tight ring. And his joints ached, and his head hurt sometimes like it was going to split in two. Because, in fact, it was trying to do exactly that. The soft spot on the top of his head could not seem to expand fast enough to make room for his growing brain. The doctors loved that part. To find out what it did to the mental function of an adult to have the brain grow. Did it disrupt memory? Or merely add to capacity? Bean submitted to their questions and measurements and scans and bloodlettings because he might not find all his children before he died, and anything they learned from studying him might help them. But at times like this, he felt nothing but despair. There was no help for him, and none for them either. He would not find them, and if he did, he could not help them. What difference has my life made? I killed one man. He was a monster, but I had it in my power to kill him at least once before and failed to do it. So don't I share in the responsibility for what he did in the intervening years? The deaths? The misery? Including Petra's suffering when she was his captive. Including our own suffering over the children he stole from us. And yet he went on searching, using every contact he could think of, every search engine on the nets, every program he could devise for manipulating the public records in order to be ready to identify which births were of his children, implanted in surrogates. For of that much he was certain. Achille and Valescu had never intended to give the embryos back to him and Petra. That promise had only been a lure. A man of less malice than Achille might have killed the embryos, as he pretended to do when he broke test tubes during their last confrontation in Hiberaun Pretu. But for Achille, killing itself was never a pleasure. He killed when he thought it was necessary. When he actually wanted to make someone suffer, he made sure the suffering lingered as long as possible. Beans and Petra's children would be born to mothers unknown to them, probably scattered throughout the world by Valescu. But Achille had done his work well. Valescu's travels were completely erased from the public record, and there was nothing about the man to make him particularly memorable. They could show his picture to 1 million airline workers and another 1 million cab drivers throughout the world, and half of them might remember seeing a man who looked like that. But none of them would be sure of anything, and Valescu's path could not be retraced. And when Bean had tried to appeal to Valescu's lingering shreds of decency, which he hoped existed against all evidence, the man had gone underground, and now all Bean could hope for was that somebody, some agency somewhere, would find him, arrest him, and hold him long enough for Bean to...
To what?
Torture him? Threaten him? Bribe him? What could possibly induce Valescu to tell him what he needed to know? Now the International Fleet had sent him some officer to give him important information. What could they possibly know? The IF was forbidden to operate on the surface of Earth. Even if they had agents who had discovered Valescu's whereabouts, why would they risk exposing their own illegal activities just to help Bean find his babies? They had made a big deal about how loyal they were to the battle school graduates, especially to Ender's Geesh, but he doubted it went that far. Money. That's what they offered. All the battle school grads had a nice pension. They could go home like Cincinnatus and farm for the rest of their lives without even having to worry about the weather or the seasons or the harvest. They could grow weeds and still prosper. Instead, I stupidly allowed children of my deformed and self-destructive genes to be created in vitro, and now Valescu has planted them in foreign wombs, and I must find them before he and people like him can exploit them and use them up and then watch them die of giantism like me before they turn 20. Valescu knows. He would never leave it to chance. Because he still imagined himself to be a scientist. He would want to gather data about the children. To him, it was all one big experiment, with the added inconvenience of being illegal and based on stolen embryos. To Valescu, those embryos belonged to him by right. To him, Bean was nothing but the experiment that got away. Anything he produced was part of Valescu's long-term study. An old man sat at the table in the conference room. It took Bean a moment to decide whether his skin was naturally dark or merely weathered into a barnwood color and texture. Both, probably. I know him, thought Bean. Mazur Rackham. The man who saved humanity in the second bugger invasion. Who should have been dead many decades ago, but who surfaced long enough to train Ender himself for the last campaign. They send you to Earth?
I'm retired, said Rackham.
So am I, said Bean.
So is Ender.
When does he come to Earth?
Rackham shook his head. Too late to be bitter about that, he said. If Ender had been here, do you think there's any chance he would be both alive and free?
Rackham had a point. Back when Achille was arranging for all of Ender's Geesh to be kidnapped, the greatest prize of all would have been Ender himself. And even if Ender had evaded capture, as Bean had done, how long before someone else tried to control him or exploit him in order to achieve some imperial ambition? With Ender, being an American as he was, maybe the United States would have stirred from its torpor, and now, instead of China and the Muslim world being the main players in the great game, America would be flexing its muscles again, and then the world really would be in turmoil. Ender would have hated that. Hated himself for being part of it. It really was better that Graf had arranged to send him off on the first colony ship to a former bugger world. Right now, each second of Ender's life aboard the starship was a week to Bean. While Ender read a paragraph of a book, 1 million babies would be born on Earth. A million old people and soldiers and sick people and pedestrians and drivers would die, and humanity would move forward another small step in its evolution into a star-faring species. Star-faring species. That was Graf's program. "You're not here for the fleet, then," said Bean. "You're here for Colonel Graf." "For the Minister of Colonization?" Rackham nodded gravely. "Informally and unofficially, yes. To inform you of an offer. Graf has nothing that I want. Before any starship could arrive on a colony world, I'd be dead."
"You'd undoubtedly be an interesting choice to head a colony," said Rackham. "But as you said, your term in office would be too brief to be effective. No, it's a different kind of offer."
"The only things I want, you don't have."
"Once upon a time, I believe you wanted nothing more than survival. It's not within your power to offer me." "Yes, it is," said Rackham.
"Oh.
From the vast medical research facilities of the International Fleet, there comes a cure for a condition that is suffered by only one person on Earth?"
"Not at all," said Rackham.
"The cure will have to come from others. What we offer you is the ability to wait until it's ready. We offer you a starship, and light speed, and an Ansible so you can be told when to come home. Precisely the gift they gave Rackham himself when they thought they might need him to command all the fleets when they arrived at the various bugger worlds. The chance of survival rang inside him like the tolling of a great bell. He couldn't help it. If there was anything that had ever driven him, it was that hunger to survive. But how could he trust them? And in return, what do you want from me?"
"Can't this be part of your retirement package from the fleet?" Rackham was good at keeping a straight face, but Bean knew he couldn't be serious.
"When I come back, there's going to be some poor young soldier I can train."
"You're not a teacher," said Rackham.
"Neither were you."
Rackham shrugged.
"So we become whatever we need to be. We're offering you life. We'll continue to fund research on your condition."
"What, using my children as your guinea pigs?"
"We'll try to find them, of course. We'll try to cure them. But they won't get their own starships."
"Bean," said Rackham, "how many trillions of dollars do you think your genes are worth?"
"To me," said Bean, "they're worth more than all the money in the world."
"I don't think you could pay even the interest on that loan."
"So I don't have as high a credit rating as I hoped."
"Bean, take this offer seriously. While there's still time. Acceleration is hard on the heart. You have to go while you're still healthy enough to survive the voyage. As it is, we'll be cutting it rather fine, don't you think? A couple of years to accelerate, and at the end, a couple more to decelerate. Who gives you 4 years?
"Nobody," said Bean.
"And you're forgetting. I have to come home. That's 4 more years. It's already far too late."
Rackham smiled. "Don't you think we've taken that into account?
What, you figured out a way to turn while traveling at light speed?
Even light bends.
Light is a wave.
So are you, when you're traveling that fast."
"Neither of us is a physicist, but the people who planned our new generation of messenger ship are," said Rackham.
"How can the IF afford to build new ships?" asked Bean.
"Your funding comes from Earth and the emergency is over. The only reason the nations of Earth even pay your salaries and continue to supply you is because they're buying your neutrality."
Rackham smiled. "Somebody's paying you to keep developing new ships," said Bean.
"Speculation is pointless.
There's only one nation that could afford to do that, and it's the one nation that could never keep its secret."
"So it's not possible," said Rackham. yet you're promising me a kind of ship that couldn't exist. You go through acceleration in a compensatory gravity field, so there's no additional strain on your heart. That lets us accelerate in a week instead of 2 years. And if the gravity fails? Then you're torn to dust in an instant. But it doesn't fail. We've tested it. So messengers can go from world to world without losing more than a couple of weeks of their lives. Of their own lives, said Rackham. But when we send someone out on such a voyage, 30 or 50 light years, everyone they ever knew is dead long before they come back. Volunteers are few. Everyone they ever knew. If he got on this starship, he'd leave Petra behind and never see her again. Was he heartless enough for that? Not heartless at all. He could still feel the pain of losing Sister Carlotta, the woman who saved him from the streets of Rotterdam and watched over him for years, until Achille finally murdered her. Can I take Petra with me? Would she go? Not without our children, said Bean. Then I suggest you keep searching, said Rackham. Because even though the new technology buys you a bit more time, it's not forever. Your body imposes a deadline that we can't put off. And you'll let me bring Petra if we find our children. If she'll go, said Rackham. She will, said Bean. We have no roots in this world except our children. Already they're children in your imagination, said Rackham. Bean only smiled. He knew how Catholic it made him sound, but that's how it felt to him and Petra both. We ask only one thing, said Rackham. Bean laughed. I knew it. As long as you're waiting around anyway, searching for your children, said Rackham, we'd like you to help Peter unite the world under the office of the hegemon. Bean was so astonished, he stopped laughing. So the fleet intends to meddle in Earthside affairs. We aren't meddling at all, said Rackham. You are. Peter doesn't listen to me. If he did, he would have let me kill Achille back in China when we first had the chance. Peter decided to rescue him instead. Maybe he's learned from his mistake. He thinks he learned from it, said Bean. But Peter is Peter. It wasn't a mistake, it's who he is. He can't listen to anyone else if he thinks he has a better plan, and he always thinks he has a better plan. Nevertheless, I can't help Peter because Peter won't be helped. He took Petra along on his visit to Alai. His top secret visit that the IF couldn't possibly know about. We keep track of our alumni. Is that how you pay for your new model starships? Alumni donations? Our best graduates are still too young to be at the really high salary levels. I don't know. You have two heads of state. Doesn't it intrigue you, Bean, to imagine what the history of the world would have been like if there had been two Alexanders at the same time? Alai and Hot Soup? Asked Bean. It'll all boil down to which of them has the most resources. Alai has most at the moment, but China has staying power. But then you add to the two Alexanders a Joan of Arc here and there, and a couple of Julius Caesars, maybe an Attila, and... You see Petra as Joan of Arc? Asked Bean. She could be. And what am I? Why, Genghis Khan, of course. If you choose to be, said Rackham. He has such a bad reputation. He doesn't deserve it. His contemporaries knew he was a man of might who exercised his power lightly upon those who obeyed him. I don't want power. I'm not your Genghis. No, said Rackham. That's the problem. It all depends on who has the disease of ambition. When Graf took you into battle school, it was because your will to survive seemed to do the same job as ambition.
but now it doesn't.
Peter's your Genghis, said Bean. That's why you want me to help him.
He might be, said Rackham. And you're the only one who can help him. Anybody else would make him feel threatened. But you?
Because I'm going to die.
Or leave. Either way, he can have the use of you, as he thinks, and then be rid of you.
It's not as he thinks. It's what you want.
I'm a book in a lending library. You lend me to Peter for a while. He turns me in, then you send me out on another chase after some dream or other. Hugh and Graff, you still think you're in charge of the human race, don't you?
Rackham looked off into the distance. It's a job that, once you take it on, it's hard to let go. One day out in space, I saw something no one else could see. And I fired a missile and killed a hive queen, and we won that war. From then on, the human race was my responsibility. Even if you're no longer the best qualified to lead it. I didn't say I was the leader. Only that I have the responsibility. To do whatever it takes. Whatever I can. And what I can do is this. I can try to persuade the most brilliant military mind on Earth to help unify the nations under the leadership of the only man who has the will and the wit to hold them all together. At what price? Peter's not a great fan of democracy.
We're not asking for democracy, said Rackham. Not at first. Not until the power of nations is broken. You have to tame the horse before you can let it have its head.
And you say you're just the servant of humanity, said Bean. Yet you want to put a bridle and saddle on the human race and let Peter ride.
Yes, said Rackham, because humanity isn't a horse. Humanity is a breeding ground for ambition, for territorial competitors, for nations that do battle. And if the nations break down, then tribes, clans, households. We were bred for war. It's in our genes. And the only way to stop the bloodshed is to give one man the power to subdue all the others. All we can hope for is that it be a decent enough man that the peace will be better than the wars and last longer.
And you think Peter's the man?
He has the ambition you lack.
And the humanity?
Rackham shook his head. Don't you know by now how human you are? Bean wasn't going to go down that road.
Why don't you and Graff just leave the human race alone? Let them go on building empires and tearing them down.
Because the Hive Queens aren't the only aliens out there. Bean sat up.
No, no, we haven't seen any. We have no evidence. But think about it.
As long as humans seemed to be unique, we could live out our species' history as we always did. But now we know that it's possible for intelligent life to evolve twice, and in very different ways. If twice, then why not three times? Or four? There's nothing special about our corner of the galaxy. The Hive Queens were remarkably close to us. There could be thousands of intelligent species in our galaxy alone, and not all of them as nice as we are.
So you're dispersing us,
as far and wide as we can, planting our seed in every soil.
And for that, you want Earth united.
We want Earth to stop wasting its resources on war, and spend them on colonizing world after world, and then trading among them so that the whole species can profit from what each one learns and achieves and becomes. It's basic economics, and history, and evolution, and science. Disperse. Vary. Discover. Publish. Explore.
Yeah, yeah, I get it, said Bean. How noble of you. Who's paying for all this now?
Bean, said Rackham, you don't expect me to tell you,
and I don't expect you to have to ask.
Bean knew. It was America. Big, sleepy, do-nothing America. Burned out from trying to police the world back in the 21st century, disgusted at the way their efforts earned them nothing but hatred and resentment, they declared victory and went home. They kept the strongest military in the world and closed their doors to immigration. And when the buggers came, it was American military might that finally blew up those first exploratory ships that scoured the surface of some of the best agricultural land in China, killing millions. It was America that mostly funded and directed the construction of the interplanetary warships that resisted the second invasion long enough for New Zealander Maser Rackham to find the Hive Queen's vulnerability and destroy the enemy. It was America that was secretly funding the IF now, developing new ships, getting its hand into the business of interstellar trade at a time when no other nation on Earth could even attempt to compete. And how will it be in their interest for the world to be united except under their leadership? Rackham smiled. So now you know how deep our game has to be. Bean smiled back. So Graf had sold his colony program to the Americans, probably on the basis of future trade and a probable American monopoly. And in the meantime, he was backing Peter in the hope that he could unite the world under one government, which would mean, eventually, a showdown between America and the hegemon. And when the day comes, said Bean, when America expects the IF, which it's been paying for and researching for, to come to its aid against a powerful hegemon, what will the IF do? What did Suryawong do when Ashiel ordered him to kill you? Gave him a knife and told him to defend himself. Bean nodded. But will the IF obey you? If you're counting on the reputation of Maser Rackham, remember that hardly anybody knows you're alive. I'm counting on the IF living up to the code of honor that every soldier has drummed into him from the start. No interference on Earth, even as you break that code yourself. We're not interfering, said Rackham. Not with troops or ships. Just a little information here and there. A dollop of money, and a little, tiny bit of recruitment. Help us, Bean, while you're still on Earth. The minute you're ready to go, we'll send you, no delays. But while you're here, what if I don't believe Peter's as decent a man as you think he is? He's better than Ashiel. So is Augustus, said Bean. But he laid the foundation for Nero and Caligula. He laid a foundation that survived Caligula and Nero and lasted for a millennium and a half in one form or another. And you think that's Peter? We do, said Rackham. I do. As long as you understand that Peter won't do a thing I say, won't listen to me or anyone, and will go on making idiotic mistakes that I can't prevent, then... Yes. I'll help him. As much as he'll let me. That's all we ask. But I'll still give my first priority to finding my children. How about this? Said Rackham. How about if we tell you where Valescu is? You know? He's in one of our safe houses, said Rackham. He accepted the protection of the IF? He thinks it's part of Ashiel's old network. Is it? Somebody had to take over his assets. Somebody could only do that if they knew where his assets were. Who do you think maintains all the communications satellites? Asked Rackham. So the IF is spying on Earth, just as a mother spies on her children at play in the yard. Good to know you're looking out for us, mummy. Rackham leaned forward. Bean. We make our plans, but we know we might fail. Ultimately, it all comes down to this.
We've seen human beings at their best, and we think our species is worth saving. Even if you have to have the help of non-humans like me. Bean, when I spoke of human beings at their best, whom do you think I was talking about?
Ender Wiggin, said Bean.
And Julian Delphiki, said Rackham. The other little boy we trusted to save the world.
Bean shook his head and stood up.
Not so little now, said Bean. And dying.
But I'll take your offer because it gives me a hope for my little family. And apart from that, I have no hope at all. Tell me where Valescu is and I'll go see him.
You'll have to secure him yourself, said Rackham. We can't have IF agents involved.
Give me the address, and I'll do the rest.
Bean ducked again to leave the room. And he was trembling as he walked through the park, back toward his office in the Hegemony compound. Huge armies prepared to clash in a struggle for supremacy. And off to one side, not even on the surface of Earth, there were a handful of men who intended to turn those armies to their own purposes. They were Archimedes, preparing to move the Earth because they finally had a lever big enough.
I'm the lever. And I'm not as big as they think I am. Not as big as I seem. It can't be done. Yet it might just be worth doing.
So I'll let them use me to try to pry the world of men loose from its age-old path of competition and war. And I'll use them to try to save my life and the lives of my children who share my disease. And the chance of both projects succeeding is so slim that the odds are much better of the Earth being hit by a disastrously huge meteor first. Then again, they probably already have a plan to deal with a meteor strike. They probably have a plan for everything. Even a plan they can turn to if... when I fail.
Chapter 5. Shiva. From Figurehead, parent at hegemon.gov, to Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov. Password, encrypted. Ray, speaking as a mother. After all these years of posing as the Madonna in your little Pietà, it occurs to me that I might whisper something in your oh-so-busy ear. Ever since Achille's little kidnapping adventure, the not-so-secret weapon in everyone's arsenal is whatever array of battle school graduates they're able to acquire, keep, and deploy. Now it's even worse. Alai is Caliph in fact as well as name. Hunzu is Emperor of China. Verlomi is... what, a goddess? That's what I hear, coming out of India. Now they will go to war against each other. What are you doing? Betting on the winner and choosing up sides? Quite apart from the fact that many of these children were Ender's friends and fellow soldiers, the whole human race owes them our very survival. We took away their childhood. When do they get a life they can call their own? Peter, I've read history. Men like Genghis and Alexander were deprived of a normal childhood and absolutely focused on war, and you know what? It deformed them. They were unhappy all the days of their lives. Alexander didn't know who he was when he stopped conquering people. If he stopped moving forward, slaughtering all the way, he died. So how about setting these children free? Have you given any thought to that? Talk to Graf. He'll listen to you. Give these children an out, a chance, a life. If for no other reason than because they're Andrew's friends, they're like Andrew. They didn't choose themselves for battle school. You, on the other hand, didn't go to battle school. You volunteered to save the world. So you have to stay and see it through. Your loving and ever-supportive mother.
A woman's face appeared on the screen. She was dressed in the simple work-stained clothing of a Hindu peasant woman.
but she bore herself like a lady of the highest caste, a concept that still had meaning despite the long-ago banning of all outward markers of caste. Peter did not know her, but Petra did. It's Velomi. All this time, said Bean, she hasn't shown her face, till now. I wonder, said Petra, how many thousands of people in India already know her face. Let's listen, said Peter. He moused the play button. No one is faithful to God who has no choice. That is why Hindus are truly faithful, for they may choose not to be Hindus, and no harm comes to them. And that is why there are no true Muslims in the world, because they may not choose to cease to be Muslims. If a Muslim tries to become a Hindu or a Christian or even a simple unbeliever, some fanatical Muslim will kill him. Pictures were flashed on the screen of beheaded bodies, well-known images but still potent as propaganda. Islam is a religion that has no believers, she said. Only people who are compelled to call themselves Muslim and live as Muslims under fear of death. Standard pictures of Muslims en masse, bowing down to pray, the very footage that was often used to show the piety of Muslim populations. But now, framed as Velomi had framed it, the images seemed to be those of puppets, acting in unison out of fear. Her face reappeared on the screen. Khalif Ali, we welcomed your armies as liberators. We sabotaged and spied and blocked Chinese supply routes to help you defeat our enemy. But your followers seem to think they conquered India rather than liberating us. You did not conquer India. You will never conquer India. Now there was news footage. Ragged Indian peasants bearing modern Chinese arms, marching like old-fashioned soldiers. We have no need of false Muslim soldiers. We have no need of false Muslim teachers. We will never accept any Muslim presence on Indian soil until Islam becomes a true religion and allows people the freedom to choose not to be Muslim without any penalty. Velomi's face again. Do you think your mighty armies can conquer India? Then you do not know the power of God, for God will always help those who defend their homeland. Any Muslim that we killed on Indian soil shall go straight to hell, for he does not serve God. He serves Shaitan. Any imam who tells you otherwise is a liar and a Shaitan himself. If you obey him, you will be condemned. Be true Muslims and go home to your families and live at peace, and let us live in peace with our own families in our own land. Her face looked calm and sweet as she uttered these condemnations and threats. Now she smiled. Peter thought she must have practiced the smile for hours, for days in front of a mirror, because she absolutely looked like a god, even though she had never seen a god and did not know how one should look. She was radiant. Was it a trick of the light? My blessing upon India. I bless the Great Wall of India. I bless the soldiers who fight for India. I bless the farmers who feed India. I bless the women who give birth to India and raise India to manhood and womanhood. I bless the great powers of the earth who unite to help us regain our stolen freedom. I bless the Indians of Pakistan who have embraced the false religion of Islam. Make your religion true by going home and letting us choose not to be Muslim. Then we will live at peace with you, and God will bless you. My blessing, above all blessings, on Khalif Ali. O noble of heart, prove that I am wrong. Make Islam a true religion by giving freedom to all Muslims. Only when Muslims can choose not to be Muslims are there any Muslims on earth. Set your people free to serve God instead of being captives of fear and hate. If you are not the conqueror of India, then you will be the friend of India. But if you intend to be the conqueror of India, then you will make yourself nothing in the eyes of God. Great Tears rolled out of her eyes and down her cheeks. This was all done in a single take, so the tears were real enough. What an actress, thought Peter. Oh, Caliph Ali, how I long to embrace you as a brother and friend. Why do your servants make war on me? She made a strange series of movements with her hands, then drew three fingers backhanded across her forehead. I am Mother India, she said. Fight for me, my children. Her image remained on the screen as all motion stopped. Peter looked from Bean to Petra and back again. So, my question is simple enough. Is she insane? Does she really believe she's a god? And will this work? What was that business at the end with the fingers on her forehead? Asked Bean. She was drawing the mark of Shiva, the destroyer, on her forehead, said Peter. It was a call to war. He sighed. They'll be destroyed. Who? Said Petra. Her followers, said Peter. Ali won't let them, said Bean. If he tries to stop them, he'll fall, said Peter, which may be what she wants. No, said Petra. Don't you see? The Muslim occupation of India absolutely counts on supplying their armies from Indian produce and Indian revenues. But Shiva will be there first. They'll destroy their own crops rather than let the Muslims have it. Then they'll die in famine, said Peter. And they'll absorb many bullets, said Petra, and beheaded Hindu bodies will litter the ground. But then the Muslims will run out of bullets, and they'll discover that they can't get more because the roads are blocked. And for every Hindu they killed, there will be 10 more to overwhelm them with their bare hands. Philomi understands her nation, her people. And all of this you understand, said Peter, because you were a prisoner in India for a few months. India has never been led into war by a god, said Petra. India has never gone to war with perfect unity. A guerrilla war, said Peter. You'll see, said Petra. Philomi knows what she's doing. She wasn't even part of Ender's Jeesh, said Peter. Ali was, so he's smarter, right? Petra and Bean looked at each other. Peter, it's not about brains, said Bean. It's about playing the hand you're dealt. Philomi has the stronger hand, said Petra. I don't see it, said Peter. What am I missing? Hansu won't just sit there while the Muslim armies try to subdue India. The Muslim supply lines either run across the vast Asian desert or through India, or by sea from Indonesia. If the Indian supply lines are cut, how long can Ali hold his armies there in numbers sufficient to keep Hansu contained? Peter nodded. So you think Ali will run out of food and bullets before Philomi runs out of Indians? I think, said Bean, that what we just saw was a marriage proposal. Peter laughed. But since Bean and Petra weren't laughing, what are you talking about? Philomi is India, said Bean. She just said so. And Hansu is China, and Ali is Islam. So, will it be India and China against the world, or Islam and India against the world? Who could sell that marriage to their own people? Which throne will sit beside the throne of India? Whichever one it is, that's more than half the population of the world united. Peter closed his eyes. So we don't want either to happen. Don't worry, said Bean. Whichever happens, it won't last. You're not always right, said Peter. You can't see that far ahead. Bean shrugged. Doesn't matter to me. I'll be dead before it all shakes out. Petra growled and stood up and paced. I don't know what to do, said Peter. I tried to talk to Ali, and all I did was provoke a coup, or rather, Petra did that. He couldn't hide his annoyance. I wanted him to control his people, but they're out of control. They're roasting cows in the streets of Madras and Bombay, and then killing the Hindus who riot. They're beheading any Indian that someone accuses of being a lapsed Muslim, or even the grandchild of lapsed Muslims. Do I just sit here and watch the world collapse into war? Petra snapped at him. I thought that was part of your plan, to make yourself seem indispensable. I don't have a great plan, said Peter. I just respond, and I'm asking you about it instead of figuring things out on my own, because the last time I ignored your advice, it was a disaster. But now I find out you don't actually have any advice, just predictions and assumptions. I'm sorry, said Bean. It didn't cross my mind you were asking for advice. Well, I am, said Peter. Here's my advice, said Bean. Your goal isn't to avoid war. Yes, it is, said Peter. Bean rolled his eyes. So much for listening. I'm listening, said Peter. Your goal is to establish a new order in which war between nations becomes impossible. But to get to that utopian place, there's going to have to be enough war that people will know the thing that they're desperate to avoid. I'm not going to encourage war, said Peter. It would discredit me completely as a peacemaker. I got this job because I'm luck. If you stop objecting and listen, said Petra, you'll eventually get Bean's advice.
I'm the great strategist, after all, said Bean with a wry smile, and the tallest man in the hegemony compound.
I'm listening, said Peter again. You're right, you can't encourage war, but you also can't afford to stop wars that can't be stopped. If you seem to try and fail, you're weak. The reason Locke was able to broker a peace between the Warsaw Pact and the West was neither side wanted war. America wanted to stay home and make money, and Russia didn't want to run the risk of provoking IF intervention. You can only negotiate peace when both sides want it badly enough to give up something in order to get it. Right now, nobody wants to negotiate. The Indians can't. They're occupied, and their occupiers don't believe they pose a threat. The Chinese can't. It's politically impossible for a Chinese ruler to settle for any boundary short of the borders of Han China. And Eli can't, because his own people are so flushed with victory that they can't see any reason to give anything up.
So I do nothing? You organize relief efforts for the famine in India, said Petra.
The famine that Valomi is going to cause,
Petra shrugged.
So I wait until everybody's sick of war, said Peter.
No, said Bean. You wait until the exact moment when peace is possible. Wait too long and the bitterness will run too deep for peace.
How do I know when the time is right?
Beats me, said Bean.
You're the smart one, said Peter. Everyone says so.
Stop the humble act, said Petra. You understand perfectly what we're saying.
Why are you so angry? Any plan we make now will crumble the first time somebody makes a move that isn't on our script.
Peter realized that it wasn't them he was angry at. It was his mother and her ridiculous letter. As if he had the power to rescue the caliph and the Chinese emperor and this brand new Indian goddess and set them free, when they had all clearly maneuvered themselves into the positions they were in.
I just don't see, said Peter, how I can turn any of this to my advantage.
You just have to watch and keep meddling, said Bean, until you see a place where you can insert yourself.
That's what I've been doing for years.
And very well, too, said Petra. Can we go now?
Go, said Peter. Get your evil scientist. I'll save the world while you're out.
We expect no less, said Bean. Just remember, you asked for the job.
We didn't.
They got up. They started for the door.
Wait a minute, said Peter.
They waited.
I just realized something, Peter said.
They waited some more.
You don't care.
Bean looked at Petra. Petra looked at Bean.
What do you mean, we don't care, said Bean.
How can you say that, said Petra. It's war, it's death, it's the fate of the world.
You're treating it like I was asking advice about a cruise, which cruise line to go on, or a poem, whether the rhymes are good.
Again, they looked at each other. And when you look at each other like that, said Peter, it's like you're laughing, only you're too polite to show it.
We're not polite people, said Petra, especially not Julian.
No, that's right. It's not that you're polite, it's that
You're so much wrapped up in each other that you don't have to laugh. It's like you already laughed, and only you two know about it. This is all so interesting, Peter, said Bean. Can we go now? He's right, said Petra. We aren't involved, like he is, I mean. But it's not that we don't care, Peter. We care even more than you do. We just don't want to get involved in doing anything about it because... They looked at each other again, and then, without saying another word, they started to leave. Because you're married, said Peter. Because you're pregnant, because you're going to have a baby. Babies, said Bean, and we'd like to get on with trying to find out what happened to them. You've resigned from the human race, is what you've done, said Peter. Because you invented marriage and children, suddenly you don't have to be a part of anything. Opposite, said Petra. We've joined the human race. We're like most people. Our life together is everything. Our children are everything. The rest is... We do what we have to. Anything to protect our children, and then beyond that, what we have to. But it doesn't matter to us as much. I'm sorry that bothers you. It doesn't bother me, said Peter. It did before I understood what I was seeing. Now I think... Sure, it's normal. I think my parents are like that. I think that's why I thought they were stupid, because they didn't seem to care about the outside world. All they cared about was each other and us kids. I think the therapy is proceeding nicely, said Bean. Now, say three Hail Marys while we get on with our limited domestic concerns, which involve attack helicopters and getting to Valescu before he makes another change of address and identity. And they were gone. Peter seethed. They thought they knew something that nobody else knew. They thought they knew what life was about. But they could only have a life like that because people like Peter and Hansu and Alai and that wacko self-deifying Verlomi actually concentrated on important matters and tried to make the world a better place. Then Peter remembered that Bean had said almost exactly what his mother said, that Peter chose to be hegemon, and now he had to work it out on his own. Like a kid who tries out for the school play, but he doesn't like the part he's been given. Only if he backs out now, the show can't go on because he has no understudy. So he's got to stick it out. Got to figure out how to save the world, now that he's got himself made hegemon. Here's what I want to have happen, thought Peter. I want every damn battle school graduate off Earth. They are the complicating factor in every country. Mother wants them to have a life. Me too. A nice long life. On another planet. But... to get them off-planet would require getting the cooperation of Graf. And Peter had the sneaking suspicion that Graf didn't actually want Peter to be an effective, powerful hegemon. Why should Graf accept the battle school kids into colony ships? They'd be a disruptive force in any colony they were in. What about this? A colony of nothing but battle school grads. If they bred true, they'd be the smartest military minds in the galaxy. Then they'd come home and take over Earth. Okay, not that. Still, it was the seed of a good idea. In the eyes of the people, it was the battle school that won the war against the buggers. They all wanted their armies to be led by battle schoolers, which is why the battle schoolers were virtually the slaves of their nation's military. So I'll do as Mother suggested. I'll set them free. Then they can all marry, like Bean and Petra, and live happily ever after. While other people, responsible people, did the hard work of running the world.
In India, the response to Virlomi's message was immediate and fierce. That very night, in a dozen incidents scattered across India, Muslim soldiers committed acts of provocation, or, as they saw it, retaliation, or defiance to Virlomi's blasphemous, outrageous accusation, thereby, of course, proving those accusations in the eyes of many. But it wasn't riots they faced this time. It was an implacable mob determined to destroy them no matter what the cost. It was Shiva, So, yes, the streets were littered with the dead bodies of Hindu civilians, but the Muslim soldiers' bodies could not be found, or at least could not be reassembled. Reports of the bloodshed flowed into Virlomi's mobile headquarters, including plenty of video. She had a selected version out on the web within hours. Lots of pictures of Muslims committing acts of provocation and then firing on the rioters. No footage of human waves swarming over the machine gun firing Muslim soldiers and tearing them to pieces. What the world would see was Muslims offending Hindu religion and then massacring civilians. They would only hear about the fact that among the Muslim soldiers, there were no survivors.
Bean and Petra boarded attack helicopters and headed out across the ocean to Africa. Bean had heard from Rackham and knew where Valescu was.
Chapter 6 Evolution. From Crazy Tom, Wackomac at sandhurst.england.gov to Magic, Legume at icomanon.com. Forwarded and posted by icomanon. Encrypted using code. Decrypted using code. Ray, England and Europe. I hope you're still using this address now that you're official and not hiding from Mr. Tendon anymore. I don't think this should go through channels. I keep getting these feelers from Wigan. I think he thinks he's got some special affinity for members of the Geesh, just because he's Ender's brother. Does he? I know he's got his fingers in everything. The items the hegemony seems to know before we do are sometimes quite amazing. But does he have his fingers in us? He's asked me for an assessment of the European willingness to surrender sovereignty to a world government. Given that the whole history of the past 200 years consists of Europe flirting with a real European government and always backing away, I wonder if the question comes from an idiot child or a deep thinker who knows more than I do. But if you think his question is a legitimate one, then let me say that surrendering sovereignty to any existing world or regional body is laughable. Only little countries like Benelux or Denmark or Slovenia are eager to join. It's like communes. People with nothing are always willing to share. Even though Europe now speaks a version of English as its native tongue, except a few die-hard enclaves, we are as far from unity as ever. Which is not to say that under the right pressure, at the right time, each proud nation of Europe might not trade sovereignty for safety. Tom.
It would have to be Fortress Rwanda, of course. The Switzerland of Africa, they called it sometimes. But it only maintained its independence and neutrality because, meter for meter, it was probably the most fortified nation on Earth. They could never have fought their way into Rwandan airspace. But a chatty phone call from Peter to Felix Starman, the Prime Minister, won them a safe passage for 2 hegemony jet choppers and 20 soldiers, along with uploads of detailed maps of the medical center where Valescu was operating. Under another name, of course. For Rwanda had been one of the places where Ashiel maintained safe houses and spy cells. What Valescu could not have known was that Peter's computer experts had been able to enter Ashiel's clandestine computer network through Suriyawang's computer, and, cell by cell, Ashiel's organization had either been co-opted, subverted, or destroyed. Valescu was depending on a Rwandan cell that had been reported to the Rwandan government. Felix Starman had chosen to continue to operate the cell through intermediaries, so the members of the cell did not realize that they were actually working for the Rwandan government. So it was no small thing for Starman, who insisted that his self-chosen name should be translated so that everyone was aware of the rather odd image he wished to convey, to give up this asset. While Bean and Petra took Valescu, the Rwandan police would be arresting all the other members of Ashiel's organization. They even promised that hegemony experts could monitor the Rwandan deconstruction of the Ashilian computers. The beat, beat, beat of chopper blades was as good as a police siren when it came to announcing their approach, so they set down a kilometer away from the medical center. Four soldiers on each chopper were equipped with slimline motorcycles, and they took off to secure all the vehicle exit points. The rest advanced through the yards and parking lots of houses, apartment buildings, and small businesses. Since the entire population of Rwanda was trained as soldiers, they knew enough to stay indoors as they watched the dark green-clad soldiers of the hegemony jog cross lots from cover to cover. They might try to telephone the government to find out what was happening, but cell phones were getting a, "We're making your service better, please have patience," message, and landlines were hearing that, "All circuits are busy." Petra was pregnant enough now that she didn't jog along with the troops. And Bean was so distinctively large that he, too, remained in the choppers with the pilots. But Bean had trained these men and had no doubt of their ability. Besides, Suriyawong, still trying to rehabilitate himself, even though Bean had assured him that he had his full trust, was eager to show that he could fulfill the mission perfectly without Bean's direct supervision. So it was only 15 minutes before Suriyawong texted them, "Fa," which either meant fait accompli, or the fourth note of the musical scale, depending on what mood Bean was in. This time, when he saw the message, he sang it out, and the choppers rose into the air. They came down in the parking lot of the medical complex. As befitted a rich country like Rwanda, it was state-of-the-art, but the architecture was designed to make the place feel homelike to its patients. So it looked for all the world like a village, with every room that did not need a controlled environment open to whatever breezes blew. Valescu was being held in the climate-controlled lab where he was arrested. He nodded gravely to Bean and Petra when they came inside. "How nice to see you again," he said. "Was anything you told us true?" asked Petra. Her voice was calm, but she wasn't going to pretend that pleasantries were in order. Valescu gave a little smile and shrug. "Doing what the boy wanted seemed to be a good idea at the time. He promised me this." "A place to conduct illegal research?" asked Bean. "Oddly enough," said Valescu, "in our new days of freedom, now that the hegemony is powerless, my research is not illegal here, so I don't have to be prepared to dispose of my subjects at a moment's notice." Bean looked at Petra. "He still says dispose of instead of murder." Valescu's smile grew sad. "How I wish I had all your brothers," he said. "But that's not why you're here. I already served my time and was legally released." "We want our babies back," said Petra. "All eight of them, unless there are more." "There were never more than eight," said Valescu. "I was observed the whole time, as you arranged, and there is no way I could have faked the number, nor could I have faked the destruction of the three discards." "I've already thought of several," said Bean, "the most obvious being that the three you pretended to find had Anton's key turned and had already been taken away. What you destroyed were someone else's embryos, or nothing at all."
"If you know so much, why do you need me?" asked Valescu.
"Eight names and addresses," said Bean. "The women who are bearing our babies."
"Even if I knew," said Valescu, "what purpose would be served by telling? None of them have Anton's key. They aren't worth studying."
"There is no non-destructive test," said Petra. "So you don't know which of them had Anton's key turned. You would have kept them all. You would have implanted them all."
"Again, since you know more than I do, by all means tell me when you find them. I'd love to know what Ashiel did with the five survivors."
Bean walked up to his biological half-uncle. He towered over him.
"My," said Valescu, "what big teeth you have."
Bean took him by the shoulders. Valescu's arm seemed so small and fragile within the grasp of Bean's huge hands. Bean probed and pressed with his fingers. Valescu winced. Bean's hands wandered idly along Valescu's shoulders until his right hand nested the back of the man's neck and his thumb played with the point of Valescu's larynx. "Lie to me again," whispered Bean.
"You'd think," said Valescu, "that someone who used to be small would know better than to be a bully."
"We all used to be small," said Petra. "Let go of his neck, Bean. Let me crush his larynx just a little." "He's too confident," said Petra. "He's very sure we'll never find them."
"So many babies," said Valescu genially. "So little time."
"He's counting on us not torturing him," said Bean. "Or maybe he wants us to," said Petra. "Who knows how his brain works? The only difference between Valescu and Ashiel is the size of their ambitions. Valescu's dreams are so very, very small." Valescu's eyes were welling up with tears.
"I still think of you as my only son," he said to Bean. "It grieves me that we don't communicate any better than this."
Bean's thumb massaged the skin of Valescu's throat in circles around the point of his larynx. "It surprises me that you can always find a place to do your sick little brand of science," said Petra. "But this lab is closed now. The Rwandan government will have its scientists go over it to find out what you were doing."
"Always I do the work while others get the credit," said Valescu.
"Do you see how I nearly encircle his throat with just one hand?" said Bean. "Let's take him back to Hibero Preto, Julian."
"That would be nice," said Valescu. "How are my sister and her husband doing? Or do you see them anymore, now that you've got to be so important?"
"He's talking about my family," said Bean, "as if he were not the monster who cloned my brother illegally and then murdered all but one of the clones."
"They've gone back to Greece," said Petra. "Please don't kill him, Bean. Please."
"Remind me why?"
"Because we're good people," said Petra.
Valescu laughed.
"You live by murder. How many people have you both killed? And if we add in all the buggers you slaughtered out in space..."
"All right," said Petra. "Go ahead and kill him." Bean tightened his fingers. Not that much, really. But Valescu made a strangled sound in his throat, and in moments his eyes were bugging out. At that moment, Suryawang entered the lab.
"General Delphiki, sir," he said.
"Just a minute, Suri," said Petra. "He's killing somebody."
"Sir," said Suryawang, "this is a war materials lab."
Bean relaxed his grip.
"Still genetic research?"
"Several of the other scientists working here had misgivings about Valescu's work and the sources of his grants. They were collecting evidence. Not much to collect, but everything points to Valescu breeding a common cold virus that would carry genetic alterations."
"That wouldn't affect adults," said Bean. "I shouldn't have said war materials," said Suryawang, "but I thought that would stop your little game of strangulation faster."
"What is it then?" asked Bean.
"It's a project to alter the human genome," said Suryawang.
"We know that's what he worked with," said Petra.
"But not with viruses as carriers," said Bean.
"What were you doing here, Valescu?" Valescu choked out some words.
"Fulfilling the terms of my grants."
"Grants from whom?"
"The grant-granters," said Valescu.
"Lock this place down," said Bean to Suryawang.
"I'll call the hegemon to request a Rwandan perimeter guard." "I think," said Petra, "that our brilliant scientist friend had some bizarre notion of remaking the human race."
"We need Anton to look at what this sick little disciple of his was doing," said Bean.
"Suri," said Petra,
Bean wasn't really going to murder him. Yes, I was, said Bean. I would have stopped him, said Petra. Suri barked out a little laugh. Sometimes people need killing. So far, Bean's record is 1-1.